It felt like the most stressful thing that I had been through until the aftermath, which became the more stressful thing. But that summer certainly felt like I could barely think of anything else.
I'm Carly Zakin.
And I'm Danielle Weisberg.
Welcome to 9 to 5-ish with The Skin.
We've run into so many questions over the years and had so many moments where we needed advice, and we got it from women who'd been there.
And that's what we're bringing you with this show. Each week, we're helping you get what you want out of your career by talking to the smartest leaders we know.
Because we know your work life is a lot more than 9 to 5.
All right, let's get into it.
Today, our guest is Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. Christine is a professor of psychology at Palo Alto University and a clinical professor at the Stanford University School of Medicine, where she is also a biostatistician. You may remember seeing Christine's name in the headlines back in 2018. In July of that year, she leveled a sexual assault accusation against Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who at the time was a Supreme Court nominee. By September 2018, she was thrust into the public eye when she testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where she alleged that Judge Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her at a high school party in the 80s. What Christine initially thought was going to be a private testimony turned out to be nationally televised, as more than 20 million people tuned in. Judge Kavanaugh has denied the allegations and ultimately was confirmed to the Supreme Court. Christine's testimony undoubtedly changed her relationship to the public. Her identity was leaked to the press leading up to her testimony, and since then, she has received death threats and has had to hide in hotels with her family. But her testimony also inspired thousands of sexual assault survivors. Christine has received 30,000 letters and counting, and many of them are from survivors who thank her for her courage and civic duty. Christine shares the story of her testimony and life in her memoir, One Way Back, which just came out in March. Christine, welcome to 9 to 5-ish.
Thank you so much. Hi.
Christine, we are honored to have you on the show today. The way we like to warm up all of our guests is with a lightning round. Are you ready?
Sure.
What is the very first job you got paid for?
Babysitting.
What is one word your students would use to describe you?
Available.
That's a nice word for a professor. You've lived on both the East and West Coast. So which coast is the best coast?
Oh, well, they're both glorious. And I've been to 48 out of 50 states, and I think they all have something to offer. But I think I'll go with Hawaii being my favorite state.
What are the two states you haven't been to?
North Dakota and Alaska.
Well, we got to get you there. So in our preparation for this interview, I have to say there was one thing that caught my eye. Metallica, you're a big fan. Wasn't expecting that. So what is your go-to Metallica song?
Fade to Black or No Leaf Clover.
What is your kind of go-to relaxation thing? How do you just bring it on down?
I like either really loud concerts or super quiet spaces. So I like to go surfing on beaches where there are hardly any people and float around in the ocean.
One person you would want to have at a dinner party, living or dead?
These are hard because I think of like so many different choices. I think one of the things in the book I said is I have a hard time with choices. So I will go with Anita Hill.
Well, that's a good transition. First of all, Christine, how are you?
I'm doing okay, thanks. Definitely a lot better and getting better every year.
I think there is not a woman of a certain age group that will not remember where they were when they watched you on camera. And I know that you weren't necessarily realizing that we were all going to watch you that day. And it kind of opened up the world of Christine, which thank you for letting us call you Christine, by the way, the world of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, though, to everybody. And that wasn't necessarily, obviously, your intent to become a public person. And so we want to use this time to get to know you a little bit better and to also be able to share your story a bit. Can you just walk us through just about your childhood? Like, you grew up around D.C. We both used to live in D.C. Like, when you're near and in the Beltway, you're kind of a part of the noise, whether or not you want to be or not. And so I would just love to, like, hear about your childhood.
I lived in a, you know, a beautiful suburb of one of our greatest cities, Washington, D.C. Spent a lot of time going there. We took a lot of field trips there to the Supreme Court, to Congress, to watch the Senate and the House, to the White House, all of the monuments. And we really soaked it all in and had great reverence for all of those institutions.
What about your family? Were you like a close family? Like, what was the dynamic?
Yeah. So I had two brothers and they went to an all-boys school and I went to an all-girls school. So we had some overlap in our friend group, especially my younger brother and I. We were in the same grade. And during the week, we studied really hard. And on the weekends, we had a lot of fun.
So obviously, as a lot of people know, and as we said in the intro, you testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I cannot begin to imagine the amount of pressure you must have felt, whether you knew it was going to be televised in that moment or not, especially since the last time someone testified about sexual misconduct in that manner was more than 3 decades ago with Anita Hill. It's safe to say there isn't really a roadmap for survivors to testify. How'd you navigate the process and making the decision to how you were going to show up? What were the steps that you took to mentally prepare?
Well, it was a very stressful summer, starting with Justice Kennedy's resignation, where I was at the beach and away for the summer. And every day just got more and more stressful, trying to figure out who I was going to tell and how I was going to share the information with people in Washington, D.C. And it felt like the most stressful thing that I had been through until the aftermath, which became the more stressful thing. But that summer certainly felt like every day it was, I could barely think of anything else other than what am I going to do and how is this going to happen? What's the best way to share this information? So it was quite stressful. And all the way up until the day before. I think the day before was the most stressful day of all. And then once I got to the seat, it was pretty overwhelming. Probably saw how overwhelmed I looked. But I will say that sitting in the seat and actually testifying was a little bit easier than the time leading up to that day.
And I actually want to say, as somebody watching, you did not look overwhelmed. You looked like a very private person who didn't want to be doing this publicly and somebody very brave. And whether or not this is beyond kind of party lines for those listening, but just, you know, as a woman recounting something that you said you experienced, that requires a tremendous amount of support. We didn't necessarily know about you that summer. You know, you weren't a household name that summer. So who did you lean on for support? Like, how much did your friends and family know what you were going through?
I leaned a great deal on my husband, who I had decided on the 4th of July that I was going to say something. And I'm also blessed with a close circle of friends, and I leaned on them quite a bit. And once I had reported to my congressperson's office and to a tip line, and then met with my congressperson, they advised that I not share so much and not talk with so many people. And so I really had to lean on a few people, and we spent some times from sunrise to sunset together just talking about what we were going to do or what I was going to do, and in between taking care of our kids and doing the things we needed to do with our kids. So there's just a lot of leaning on friends, and in times of crisis, there are just always those people that show up and are willing to be there for you.
I just I'm going back to that day of watching you. The Skim has a lot of women who work here. And I remember that day, it was kind of like this semicircle of women around our TV screen in the kitchen area. And we very rarely have the volume up. And we did, and we were all watching it kind of in silence, hearing your words. You've talked about detaching yourself from the outcome of your testimony. How did you actually do that? And is that something that you actively thought going into it? Like, the only way that I'm going to be able to do this is if I detach? Or is that something that you, in retrospect, have worked on?
That was something I worked on ahead of time. And it seemed to serve me well to say, there's nothing ultimately I can do to control the government or how the senators vote. I can just weigh in with my letter of non-recommendation and share my information. And then I can live with myself that I did the right thing and try to preserve my sense of patriotism, my sense of civic duty, and then let it play out. Because if you start to get really attached to the outcome, like I need a certain thing to happen or not happen, it added so much more stress. And once I was able to think about it in a way where the outcome was just completely out of my control, then it made it easier to take one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward.
There are a lot of situations where it would be helpful to detach yourself from the outcome of something, because there are a lot of times when the outcome is just not up to us. When you said you practiced that, what are some things that you actually did?
Yeah, well, first I want to say I'm not an expert at detaching from outcomes by any means. My kids are trying to decide where to go to college, and I feel completely attached to the outcomes. I wish I was not attached to the outcomes. But for this, it was a level of stress so high, and it's also just the knowledge and learning more about how political some of these decisions are and how they're made, and just informing myself of how little impact one citizen's testimony can have on any outcome. So I was able to let go of that. And certainly I had some hope that my testimony would have some influence or some impact. So it wasn't like I gave up. It wasn't like I was totally detached from the whole thing. But I did have to say that it is up to them and that they are the deciders. I'm not the decider.
Do you remember in all of this, when was the first time you realized that your credibility was being questioned? And I want to preface for those who don't know so much about your background, like, you're a scientist. Your career is guided by working with data. So I imagine that's kind of insult to injury when you feel like you have the data and the argument to not have others see it the way that you're seeing it. And so knowing all of that, when was the first moment that you remember being like, oh, they don't believe me?
Yeah, I'm not sure I ever felt like they didn't believe me. I felt at risk for being attacked, even when I was thinking about it 3 months before you saw me on TV. And in the book, I talk about the very first day, just thinking of all of the bad things I'd ever done in my own life and people saying to me, all of that's going to come out. And it was so abstract. I wasn't super afraid of that. I thought, okay, well, a couple of people will say mean things about me. And that just didn't seem to weigh very much against the value of the Supreme Court and the value of our country and my personal sense of duty. So I was sort of willing to take whatever was going to come my way. And I certainly underestimated it, though. I didn't know it would be at scale and be sort of an ongoing thing and become a formal thing with a media smear campaign and smear books, et cetera.
I think one of the things that, for those who just remember the testimony and kind of the media hysteria around that time, don't necessarily realize that you talk about in the book One Way Back, is you didn't expect to be, well, one, your name was never supposed to be shared. So your name ended up being leaked. And two, you didn't expect when you gave your testimony that it was going to be televised on C-SPAN and then obviously picked up elsewhere. And three, you didn't realize that now Justice Kavanaugh was going to bring his whole family, like that you were supposed to bring like all your people, like as kind of character support. Knowing all of that, like there's a lot behind the scenes, like we didn't realize at the time. And so I'm curious, as you kind of decided to write a book and sort of recount trauma that you went through, both the trauma that you talk about happened way back then and also the trauma that happened in front of the world, was writing about it therapeutic or actually traumatic?
the writing about it was sometimes really traumatic and I would have to set it aside. And it took several years and several attempts to get through the writing. But what was really therapeutic, interestingly, was when I read the book for the audio, having to read it out loud and saying it out loud for some reason was a lot more therapeutic than wrangling with what is the right word here and what is the right sentence and how do I convey this. So it ultimately was therapeutic, and talking about it now is therapeutic.
How did you think about making the decision to go back into the public eye in writing a book?
Well, it was a stressful situation for me, sort of like when we were doing the warm-up and of all the choices, and there seemed to be so many choices, writing an op-ed, disappearing forever, or writing a book, or doing an interview with the news. There were different avenues to choose from. And I think that the writing piece, I was convinced by, you know, very close friends and trusted experts that would be a slower process and that I could share what I wanted to share and paint a more full picture than I might be able to paint in another media setting.
I want to talk about Anita Hill. Not only in our lightning round did you invite her to our fictional dinner, but you were able to connect with her kind of after all of this. Can you just talk to us about what that interaction was like at first?
Sure. So one of our interactions is I had the honor of introducing her when she was giving a talk at University of Washington in Seattle. And for security reasons, I was a surprise guest and I went out to introduce her. And it was just a wonderful evening and she had so much support. And I got to spend some time with her and backstage and talk to her before she went out on stage and did her speech. So
was that the first time you met her?
It wasn't the first time I had interacted with her, but it was the first time we really got to talk.
I feel like, and we have not interviewed Anita Hill before, but you are truly kind of the only two women that know what that experience of testifying is like and having your credibility questioned on a national stage in that forum. What is that connection with her like?
Yeah, it's really special because, as you say, in that forum is sort of what distinguishes it from other situations. And I was a little bit stuck for a while thinking, we're the only two people that could ever understand this situation where you're coming from a place of civic duty and patriotism and you're trying to help the country and the people that you're trying to help actually hurt you. It's very difficult. But having now connected with other survivors and connected with survivors across all 50 states and 42 countries, I'm learning that being in court or being in another venue is also incredibly stressful. Yes, we were in a unique forum, but other people have their own stressors when they're bringing their story forward and going through a process in a different setting.
You dedicated your book to the letter writers who flooded your living room with thousands and thousands of letters saying that you sharing your story helped them. Can you share some of the things that you found impactful?
Sure. In the book, there's a photo of my dining room, so you can see the visual of the ones of the letters we were working on at the time. But the letter writers really meant everything to me. They, for every thought I had, negative or positive or scary or refreshing, there were so many letter writers that were echoing back exactly what I was thinking or what I was fearing or being sad about or being happy about. So I felt like I had 100,000 new friends and people who I could turn to in a time of otherwise not very wonderful experience. So some lonely times, they were there and they would take pen to paper and get a stamp and an envelope and write, put stickers on the outside of the envelope, convey to me that it was a safe letter and just incredibly thoughtful.
Have you met any of these letter writers in person yet?
I've met people in person who tell me that they were one of the letter writers. So yes. And just before the pandemic, we were going to start meeting some of the letter writers. So we had a big plan of going to a few states like Nevada. We were going to go there and meet with some of the letter writers there. And so that's something I still hope to do, is to connect with them personally.
In the book, and you mentioned this, like, you use the metaphor of surfing both in your life and throughout the book. And when I think about surfing, and I will preface, I do not surf because it terrifies me. But when you think about surfing, you're finding balance and standing on your own. And, you know, you can have a lot of support and training or whatever, but like, you are standing on your own. And I think that's an amazing metaphor to describe what it is you've gone through over these last few years. When we talk about the support, you know, one of the things I was struck about that you've publicly talked about is your relationship with your family today. Your parents knew and know the Kavanaugh family. Like, you know, you all grew up going to the same places. And, you know, one of the things you've talked about is that your dad had emailed Justice Kavanaugh's dad after everything had sort of settled. When you think about kind of surfing through all of this and all of the waves, like, how have you dealt with sort of the family aspect of it and this huge, huge story that in the end also just affected two families from the same town?
Yeah, I do talk about that in the book, and I wanted to share that story. I was partially inspired by the letter writers who were so generous in sharing their families, because we all have complex families. Many of us have complex families. And so I felt like I wanted to be as generous back with them so that they knew that I also had a complex family. And yes, that was a hard wave to ride. That was not easy and wasn't the best wave of my life, that's for sure. But it's something that people have to grapple with. I think in other topics, we're all sort of in a time where people are divided, whether it's about politics or other things, where we have to figure out how to continue those relationships and what those relationships can look like and how can they be healthy and how can we stay attached to our families if we choose to be attached.
We have a question from our newsletter audience. Do you have any advice on learning to validate yourself and your experience when other people doubt you?
I wasn't great at that for a couple of years. It was really upsetting for me when people would doubt it. And then I also felt that when people did validate me, when people said, I believe you, and were really validating, that I noticed that that's not super validating for me, actually. It was as if I was saying, my name is Christine, and people said, I believe you. I guess I just got to a point where I didn't really need other people to validate or believe me. I want to say it took a long time to get to that point of understanding. I talk about this as the ocean abyss in the book, that if you are alone and no one believed you, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And many survivors who wrote to me were in that situation where their assault occurred and no one believed them and no one else knew about it.
It's interesting that you say that the I believe you is actually not helpful, because my guess, if I was trying to comfort somebody in a similar situation, I would want to say that. So do you have advice? What was the type of support that was most impactful for you?
I think it's a nice thing to say. You're okay saying that to people. I think we understand that that comes from a really nice place of support. So it's fine. And it's a great place to start, and it shows care and validation. Maybe one thing we could think about is that there aren't really other things in our lives. Like if I said, I got in a car accident or I had some other problem, I don't think that in those situations, people respond with, I believe you. They respond maybe with, are you okay? Or is there something that I can do? I'm here to listen.
In writing this book, do you feel like it is closing the chapter on something that you don't want to talk about again? Or like, how do you think about this in sort of like the fabric of your story?
I'm not sure. I think it closes a chapter for sure. And the next chapter, or the next book of building my new life is probably going to be quite different. It's already a lot more minimized and simple, and I'm really enjoying it. So I think I'll probably continue on that path for a while, but I don't think that I'm going to be silent. I'm not going to go back into silence.
Our final question, who is somebody else we should have on the show?
Gosh, there's so many.
I know you don't like choice.
I know, I like multiple. I like multiple choice. These are called open-ended questions. I need a multiple choice on that one. There's so many. Have you had Chanel Miller?
No.
No, we haven't.
I would highly recommend Chanel.
Well, Christine, thank you very much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9 to 5-ish with The Skim. A new episode will be in your feed again next Wednesday. And if you want to keep up with us in between episodes, follow us on Instagram at Carly and Danielle.
It's a really good account, I promise.